从台湾、印尼、俄罗斯、韩国、印度、欧盟、巴西到美国，2024一整年总共有超过70个国家要举行选举，可以说是一个超级选举年。然而全球民主也正在面临着前所未有的危机，著有《妖风：全球民主危机与反击之道》的民主理论大师、斯坦福大学胡佛研究所的戴雅门教授 Larry Diamond 做客美国之音纵深视角，详细阐述了俄罗斯的入侵、中国的野心、美国的国内问题以及民粹主义所刮起的四股妖风为全球民主带来的挑战，并提出了逆风而行和击退风暴的因应策略。戴雅门教授也对中国正在成为一个更加集权的国家感到担忧，他认为习近平和中共的领导人们虽然极力想要避免步上前苏联的后尘，却反而是事与愿违的正在重蹈前苏联的覆辙。下面请看本期邹生视角与戴雅门教授的专访。Professor Diamond, thank you so very much for coming on our show.
It's my pleasure.
2024 is a tough year for democracy worldwide, affecting nearly half of the world's population. According to the EIU Democracy Index, out of more than 70 elections in 2024, only around like 43 are expected to be fully free and fair.So what's your take on where democracy is in the most danger? Can you please pick out three elections scheduled for this year you consider the most important for global democracy?
Well, I'll just pick the three biggest democracies in the world. How about that? We'll go in order of population size. The first one is India, where Prime Minister Narendra Modi,who's been in power for 10 years now, and his BJP, have to renew their mandate for their government, which comes every 5 years in India's parliamentary system. So parliamentary elections are due in India by sometime in May. Prime Minister Modi is extremely popular, and India has been a great success story economically and in terms of its rising global power under his leadership. It's had the fastest economic growth rate in the last 10 years of any major country, averaging 7.5% a year, but it's also seen a dramatic decline in the quality of democracy and the extent of freedom in India.And you now have a situation where civil society, the press, the universities, think tanks, the business community, they're all under withering political pressure by the ruling party and the state, which has increasingly been politicized by the ruling party, the BJP. You have civil society organizations and think tanks that have been shut down.You have intellectuals who have fled into exile. You have people being prosecuted for, the weaponization of the tax authorities for political purposes. These are the kinds of things you expect to see in a country like Russia, not in the world's largest democracy. So I think the votes will be counted freely andaccurately on election day in India, but it is certainly possible to ask at this point, with the extreme assaults on the independent media and civil society, and the weaponization of the state for the advancement of the ruling party, whether India is still a democracy. I think this is an open question.The next largest democracy is the United States, and we will have an election in November of this year for the next 4-year presidential term in the United States. That Freedom House rates the level of political rights and civil liberties of all the countries in the world every year on a 100-point scale. And going back to about 2012, Freedom House has noted a 9-point decline in the extent or quality of freedom and democracy in the United States. And we have very serious problems of political polarization, very serious vulnerabilities to disinformation by hostile authoritarian powers that don't wish us well, particularly Russia and China. So we have a lot of work to do to shore up American democracy and to ensure that we have an election in November of this year in which people have confidence and trust with transparent procedures and so on. The third democracy, third largest, has just held its election recently. That is Indonesia. And the former general and son-in-law of the late dictator, Suharto, Prabowo Subianto, has, by all accounts, won the presidential election. Many people are concerned about the decline of democracy in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. Many people are concerned that the incumbent president, Joko Widodo, endorsed Prabowo only because Prabowo made his 36-year-old son the vice presidential candidate, positioning him to be a future president. And it's a general, another general indication of concerns about decline in the quality of democracy, the independence of institutions, the competitiveness of the political system, and so on. So those are three big democracies that are holding elections in 2024.
Let's talk about your book. Back in 2019, you wrote the book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and America's Complacency. Do you think the current situation has gotten worse in these three areas compared to 4 years ago? How can we change the direction of the wind? And do you see any silver lining out there?
So let me talk about four ill winds, okay? Russian rage, Chinese ambition, American complacency, and what I was referring to a moment ago, which is the general march of illiberal populism in many countries around the world. Mm-hmm. We'll just go down the list. Russian rage has definitely gotten worse. Russia hadn't invaded Ukraine a second time when I published my book in 2018, 2019. And it's very, very alarming. You now have, in my view, fully unhinged Russian dictator Vladimir Putin, who has taken, as we know, the latest evidence of this is the death of the principal opposition leader in the country, Alexei Navalny. His regime has taken an increasingly murderous turn, unafraid to kill its opponents both at home and abroad, and increasingly aggressive. We not only have an ongoing existential threat to Ukraine, but the Baltic states are now worried that Russia, an emboldened Russia, a militarily expanding Russia, a militarily modernizing Russia, and an increasingly vulgar and aggressive dictator, Vladimir Putin, could turn next and actually invade a NATO country. So Russia is a far more dangerous country now than it was when I published my book 5 years ago. Then we come to the People's Republic of China. What has Beijing done in the last 5 years? They've declined economically as a result of their mismanagement and their disastrous shutdown during the COVID era. And the increasing paranoia of China's paramount ruler, Xi Jinping, which has led to a very broad crackdown on the business community, the particularly major entrepreneurs, and I think has really destroyed investor confidence and the confidence of a lot of the people who are laying the golden eggs that are advancing the Chinese economy. But at the same time, Xi Jinping has become more aggressive in the South China Sea, more aggressive in terms of military pressure and threats against Taiwan, probably more aggressive and innovative in the use of disinformation against Taiwan, and embarked on a relentless, staggering, and frightening headlong effort to develop the military means to swallow Taiwan when Xi Jinping and his fellow leaders decide the time is right. So I think both for Taiwan specifically and for the countries around the perimeter of China, which are principally Japan, Korea, the Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, and every country, Malaysia, that has a stake in and a border on the South China Sea, the situation has gotten much more dangerous with China. And China's become much more assertive on the global stage in UN forums and other international arenas. And with the expansion, further expansion, which I documented in my book, of its global propaganda apparatus, the Voice of China, which has nothing of the commitment to truth and open exploration, if I might say so, of the Voice of America. And then finally, with respect to the wave of illiberal populism that's been sweeping the world, Hungary, Poland, Turkey, and so on, I think things have gotten a little better. And the most important development has been the victory of liberal, democratically committed forces in the Civic Coalition in Poland in the October 15th, 2023 election in Poland. I actually think the famous year of elections, 2024, began in October of 2023 in Poland. That was a very critical test because the ruling party, the Law and Justice Party, had been really squeezing liberal democracy and trying to politicize the courts, politicize the state, intimidate liberal critics. It was getting very scary, and they lost at the polls. They were defeated by a more democratically committed coalition. And so I think that that's good news in showing, as we've seen elsewhere, it happened 5 years before in Greece when a centrist political party led by a very skillful Democrat, the current prime minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, defeated a left-wing populist government in Greece in 2019. And now Greece is kind of a democratic and economic success story again. So there is some good news.
So you think that the super election year should start the end of last year with Poland. But let's talk about Taiwan in January, because you had an opportunity to witness the presidential election in Taiwan, which I think literally kicked off the super election year in January. Despite the pressure and the interference from the CCP, William Lai, Lai Ching-te, defeated his opponents from KMT and TPP comfortably. And he's going to deliver a crucial inaugural speech in May. Based on your firsthand observations there, what are the key achievements of Taiwan's democracy as well as challenges following election?
Well, one of the key achievements of democracy in Taiwan is that it's just had once again, I think for the eighth time since Lee Teng-hui was elected under the first free and fair democratic direct presidential election in 1996, which completed the transition to democracy in Taiwan. Taiwan has had another well-run, fairly administered, and very impressive exercise of electoral democracy. The Central Election Commission in Taiwan really does an excellent job of administering elections and counting the vote. I wish all the election officials in the U.S. could go to Taiwan and to observe and see how well it's done. The judgment of independent ratings agencies is that Taiwan's democracy has been going like this, and the U.S. democracy has been declining a bit. So, but Taiwan, we'll come to this. Taiwan does face challenges, but let's first talk about the achievements. It's had a series, uninterrupted since 1996, every 4 years, of free and fair and well-administered elections. I'm not going to say they're perfect. There still are traces of a phenomenon that used to be more of a problem in Taiwan, what's called black gold, the influence of money and, organized crime networks and so on. But those have largely been beaten back by the efforts of Ministry of Justice task forces and so on. And it's got a very vigorous free press. There's a lot of polarization in the society. That's one of the challenges. But it's a very open society and a very free and creative civil society. And look, it's produced an economic miracle on the island multiple times early on with the shift to industrialization, then with the shift to a higher level of technology, and then to become the leading supplier of semiconductors, particularly advanced semiconductors in the world, and a source of investment throughout East Asia and now Southeast Asia, and a beacon of freedom in the world. I mean, a lot of international democracy conferences take place in Taiwan because it's inspiring and people want to see it and they want to be there. So I think this is really remarkable. The challenges are, in part, the challenges of a maturing, advanced industrial society. The challenges that Japan faces, Korea faces, France faces, Germany faces, of a population that's rapidly aging, with a low birth rate, actually in Taiwan, one of the lowest in the world. And therefore, you know, all these countries, whether it's Japan, Taiwan, they're either going to need to have more kids or import more people. Otherwise, the math doesn't work. And Taiwan is such an appealing society. I mean, you have Americans that are moving there and really discovering how wonderful it is to live there and marrying Taiwanese partners and so on and so forth. So Taiwan will need to change. Japan will need to change. They know this. And there'll be challenges for the healthcare system and challenges for the next generation of economic growth and technological innovation and challenges in beating back a new generation of disinformation, probably originating from the PRC that will be super empowered by artificial intelligence. And it's just to say, whether you're talking about the economic competition in a globalized world economy or the political competition between democracy and authoritarianism, countries need to stay fit. They need to maintain their edge. They can't relax. Competition is just too intense.
With the tensions escalating in the Taiwan Strait and also the war in Ukraine, you know, apparently becoming a protracted one after 2 years, how important are the fates of Taiwan and Ukraine in this broader picture of democracy versus authoritarian regimes? What are those scenarios you foresee might unfold in these two areas? I mean, Taiwan and Ukraine.
Well, the most important thing that can be said at the outset is that these two great challenges to world peace and the future of freedom in the world are intimately linked. Mm-hmm. Because dictators around the world and autocracies more generally are constantly looking around and drawing signals as to what they can get away with, depending on what's happening elsewhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And we had, particularly during World War II, a stunning affirmation of the lesson that when aggression goes unchecked and unrepelled, it invites more aggression, not only by the aggressor of the moment, but by others who lust after the territory of their neighbors. Mm-hmm. So you have to stop authoritarian aggression at its earliest point of manifestation, or it will get worse, it will get emboldened, it will send bad signals, the aggressor will become stronger, and the situation will become much more severe. So Ukraine is existentially threatened now, 2 years after the start of this war. It's urgently important that we in the United States and Europe get Ukraine all of the weapons and all of the ammunition that it needs to defend itself. They're not just fighting for themselves. They're fighting for us. They're fighting for the rest of the Europe. They're fighting for freedom. They're fighting for the United States not having to fight directly in these conflicts. And I will say, perhaps this will come as a surprise to your viewers, but I think they're fighting for Taiwan. Because if you, and this is why China has come in on the side of Russia in Ukraine, if Ukraine is defeated in the war that Russia has inflicted on it, or if Russia can just with abandon gobble up a significant piece of Ukraine, or keep NATO, the United States, and the West bogged down in a war there for many years, what will that mean for Taiwan? You have one of the most remarkable democracies in the world, probably the most liberal democracy in Asia, but, you know, 23 million people against 1.4 billion, vastly outgunned, outmanned, and so on. And Taiwan will not be able to match the People's Liberation Army plane for plane, ship for ship, nor does it need to. It needs to develop a more mobile, innovative, lethal, and unconventional military that in partnership with the United States, and implicitly at least, I hope Japan, will make it clear to the Beijing leaders that an effort to compel Taiwan to give up its democracy and assimilate into the People's Republic of China by force will not be successful, and that Beijing would risk humiliating defeat by trying to play the military card. So we have time. I don't think China wants a war now. Its economy is in too much crisis. We have time to strengthen Taiwan's defenses, particularly the asymmetrical dimensions of its defenses, to strengthen deterrence in general by the United States and Japan, not for the purpose of advancing some stealth agenda of Taiwan independence. I think this would be a disastrous mistake, but simply to preserve the status quo, and to preserve the status quo until such time as there's a political reality across the strait where some kind of agreement could be negotiated that would be mutually acceptable to each side. I personally don't think that can happen until the mainland China itself is a democracy, but I think someday it will be.
I want to focus on the economic crisis you just mentioned about a little bit more, because we know Xi Jinping and the CCP, they are trying everything they could to avoid ending up just like the Soviet Union. But it seems that now they are inevitably faced with an agonizing dilemma between party survival and economic growth. What consequences do you think an economic downturn, or if I may, just like you said, economic crisis could have on Xi Jinping personally, CCP, and China's political future?
Well, I think this is one of the most important questions that could be asked in world politics today, because it's not just that China has fallen into a protracted economic crisis. Mm-hmm. The real rate of economic growth in China today is probably around zero. It might be slightly positive. It might be slightly negative. No serious economist outside of China believes the fantasy figures that the Chinese Communist Party state is putting out. And not only that, something else is happening that's extremely noteworthy, that many of the major entrepreneurs in China mm-hmm. have lost confidence in the Chinese Communist Party, feel very alienated from the leadership of China now and Xi Jinping. And in private circles, Xi Jinping is being openly derided as a blundering, incompetent, power-hungry figure who's dragging China down. And I think that there is a kind of political crisis brewing in China as well. Not necessarily that it will threaten Xi Jinping's rule, but it's bringing upon China now many of the signs of stagnation and declining confidence that we could see in the Soviet Union in the 1970s and early 80s. And I think political leaders throughout world history often draw the wrong lessons from history. Mm-hmm. So Xi Jinping and his fellow leaders in China feel nothing more passionately and with greater conviction than that they must avoid the fate of Mikhail Gorbachev. Mm-hmm. And in their view, Gorbachev brought ruin on the Soviet Communist Party by opening up the political system and bringing about economic reform, perestroika. And I think they're drawing the wrong lesson. In trying so obsessively to hold on, heighten repression, extend and deepen control, personalized control under the one-man rule of Xi Jinping, so as to avoid the fate of Mikhail Gorbachev, I think they're going to bring on the fate of Mikhail Gorbachev. And the longer they wait, the more difficult that reform and opening will be, mm-hmm. and the more disastrous will be the ultimate consequence for the Chinese Communist Party.
I want to talk about another wrong lesson from history, because there was a time when people thought China might head toward democracy, especially with its opening market and joining the WTO. But however, now we see Xi Jinping's China dream seems more like an Orwellian nightmare. What's your assessment of this new totalitarianism advanced by digital technology? Can we still hold on to hope for China's transition to democracy?
Well, you've got three questions there, so let me separate them. Question one, did we get China wrong in our well-intentioned and I think honorable desire to help China open up and to integrate it into the world trading system? And the answer to that, I think, is an unequivocal yes. Mm-hmm. And even many of my friends who were most enthusiastic about that, mm-hmm. most in favor of that, like my frequent academic partner and co-editor, Orville Schell, mm-hmm. have said as much. We got China wrong, and it was a mistake, and China badly abused the international trading rules. And I think part of our mistake, which I hope will now reverse, has not been enforcing the rules. When a country massively subsidizes its industries to drive out other competitors in world markets and engages in what is, you know, termed under the WTO dumping of products at below cost prices in order to gain control of a market, countries have the right to impose countervailing duties, countervailing tariffs. And we should have begun doing so long ago. And I think we now need to do so with electric vehicles and a lot of other things where there's evidence of China's violation of international trading rules. The second question you asked is about the nature of the regime today. And I mean, the term you posed, I think, is extremely accurate, Orwellian. That China has appropriated for the purposes of state security and the purposes of political repression all of the most advanced technologies of surveillance, communication, and control. It is a neo-Orwellian state. There's never been a state in the history of the world that has used such pervasive and sophisticated methods to monitor its population. And it's a country of fear, and it's why a lot of people don't want to live there anymore and are trying to get out. And, you know, why a lot of entrepreneurs, they don't, you know, put an announcement in the newspaper saying, this country is a wreck. I'm tired of living in a totalitarian dictatorship. Bye-bye, I'm leaving. They just quietly leave. And if they can't get their money out, you know, they get some of it out and they start a new life elsewhere. And maybe quietly they go back from time to time, maybe not, but they want to breathe like that remarkable young Chinese student who gave the commencement address at the University of Maryland, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, said in her commencement address, we want to breathe the fresh air of freedom. It's very intoxicating. It's very healthy for people to breathe that fresh air. So I think that China is an increasingly neo-totalitarian state, and this is very alarming. As to the future
of China.
I am, of course, worried about the near term that Xi Jinping might start a war that would bring ruin for everyone. But I'm not despairing. I think that with the correct deterrence and the correct engagement, I think we need engagement with the Chinese leadership and the correct restraint. I've already said that. I think maintaining the status quo across the strait is very important. So I would not be supportive of any move by the Taiwan government that would change the status quo in the direction of gesturing toward independence. And I don't think that will happen under the incoming president, Lai Ching-te. I think the status quo will be preserved. But in the medium term, I think the contradictions, to use a favorite word of the Communist Party, are going to grow. The system just is not consistent with human nature and human innovation and sustained economic growth and, you know, the kind of society that educated people when they discover what the possibilities are around the world want to live in. And so I think there's value change going on in China. I think more people will want to have, they may not fully understand democracy, but a more open and less repressive society. And I think that if the Communist Party doesn't adapt in that way gradually, they'll face, again, the classic communist word, a growing contradiction.
Do you worry about this transition to democracy in China would be a bloody one?
No, I don't think a transition to democracy would be or could be bloody, because if it were bloody, I don't think democracy would be the result. I think that the most likely scenario is what happened in the Soviet Union. That it will be some form of peaceful political change.
I was in Hong Kong back in 2019 when pro-democracy activists like Joshua Wong and others, they called their city the New Berlin in a new Cold War era at that time. And they said they were fighting on the front line between democracy and authoritarianism. But now, what we're seeing now is the tragic Hong Kong decline under this draconian national security law. How do you interpret Hong Kong's downfall in this global fight for democracy? And do you see a dictator's learning curve in Hong Kong's case?
The demise of semi-democracy in Hong Kong, it was never a full democracy, it was always under PRC domination, but limited domination. There was truth until the imposition of the draconian national security law and the dissolution of a democratic or partially democratic legislative council and the imprisonment of large numbers of democracy activists that went along with that. Until all that happened in 2019-2020, Hong Kong was different than the mainland. There was something like one country, two systems. The second system, Hong Kong, was not a democracy, but it had elements of democracy, elements of a free press, elements of an open and strong civil society, elements of a rule of law. And, it was a pretty free political place. They couldn't fully determine their own future, but they had political voice and significant civil and political freedom. And that was crushed. Not in the way I expected, actually. I expected PLA troops to march into Hong Kong. And I'll give Xi Jinping credit for being smarter than I expected he would be.
Lessons from Tiananmen Square.
Yes, yes. And they did it in a much cleverer way, more incremental, a little more subtle, working through the police authorities in Hong Kong. But the result has been large. They didn't kill a lot of people, but the result otherwise has been largely the same, the snuffing out of aspirations for freedom. And it's heartbreaking, I'm sure, for you, having been there. It's heartbreaking for me. I had a lot of friends there. I think of Joshua Wong as one of them. I have enormous admiration for this young man and his courage and the generation of others in jail and hiding and exile and so on. I have extraordinary admiration for Jimmy Lai. Keep in mind that, like Alexei Navalny, Lai did not need to go back to Hong Kong.
But they choose to.
Lai felt he had to be with the people who were struggling for a free press and an open society, that he couldn't just take his money and live comfortably abroad and abandon them. And it's very rare that you see that kind of courage in our lives and in our societies, particularly among people who have the kind of resources and could live the kind of comfortable life he did. He's a man of very deep conviction. I think he should win the Nobel Peace Prize. I have just boundless admiration for him. I will say analytically that the mistake, I think, that the Hong Kong pro-democracy movement made was not a moral one. It was an analytical one. Hong Kong was not like Berlin. Half of Berlin was under Western control. All of Hong Kong was ultimately under PRC control, right? That was the outcome of the handover in 1997. So at any time, it was possible for China to do what it ultimately did in Now it's revealed its duplicity, its hypocrisy, its untrustworthiness, its repressiveness. And everybody else, not least in Taiwan, has been given due notice.
What do you make of the concept of authoritarian alignment that came up recently in a congressional hearing on the Selected Committee on CCP, which focused on China's increasing support for America's enemies, including Russia, Iran, you name it? How big of a threat you think it poses to democracy and the Western world?
The term axis of evil was first floated. I don't think there was a real axis of evil. Mm-hmm. I think it was well-intentioned, but analytically misplaced. There is a real axis of evil now. Mm-hmm. And as with the Axis powers during the 1930s and through World War II, it consists of three malign, authoritarian, aggressive actors. Then it was Germany, Italy, and Japan. Now it is Russia, China, and Iran. And of course, others come in and cooperate, like North Korea, which is sending arms to and ammunition to Russia. But the core of this is obviously the growing cooperation between the People's Republic of China and Vladimir Putin's Russia. This is extremely dangerous, very cynical, has its own elements of instability and potential betrayal by each actor of the other. It's not like they fully trust one another, but it's very dangerous. And it has to be met by deepened, principled, allied, democratic cooperation.
Let's talk about more about your thoughts on the upcoming U.S. presidential election. If Trump is either excluded from the ballot or wins the election, what kind of signal do you think each outcome sends to the democracy worldwide?
First of all, a president and a former president running against one another. Mm-hmm. And second of all, each of the two candidates having been decided so early. And you'll have a 7 to 8 month, very long campaign, very intense, very hard fought, with very high stakes. What can be said objectively, I think, on the basis of what we're hearing and seeing, is that America's allies in Europe, probably in Asia as well, are alarmed at the possibility of Trump being reelected because he has shown, it seems, a cavalier attitude toward the NATO alliance and the defense of our alliances and a lot of sympathy for authoritarian actors abroad. It's not just his love affair with Vladimir Putin. He also has a love affair with the worst tyrant in the world, Kim Jong-un. So it will be challenging. People will be following the election with a lot of anxiety from elsewhere in the world. Putin with a lot of anticipation because he knows that Trump will go light on him if he's elected. Maybe pull the plug completely on support for Ukraine. So it will be a very consequential and internationally closely scrutinized election.
You talk about the European allies' concern regarding Trump. I want to share two very different opinions I recently come across. One is from Chris Patton. He's a former Hong Kong governor. By saying if Trump wins, so will China. But on the other hand, also there are quite a few Chinese democracy activists that I know. They argue that if Trump loses, America becomes CCP because they view those trials as political persecution, similar to what they saw the CCP does to its opponent. What's your take on those very different views here?
I have great affection for and solidarity with the all the pro-democracy activists in China. And many of them are, again, my personal friends. But I think their views of the American, the ones that have the view of the American political situation that they have, that the Democrats in the U.S. are somehow better for Xi Jinping and Trump is worse for Xi Jinping, and therefore all people who want democratic change in China should support him, is, I think, wildly at odds with the facts and bordering on completely unhinged, blinded by their anger at the CCP and failing to just take stock of reality. And the reality is that no American president has issued a stronger statement of resolve to defend Taiwan than Joe Biden. And that this Biden administration has done a lot, much of it quietly, not bombastically, to strengthen America's strategic posture in the region and strategic partnerships, both the Quad partnership, Japan, U.S., India, Australia, and other alliances, our military partnership, an alliance with Korea, the resumption and strengthening of our alliances and basing in the Philippines is a huge development. And, you know, planning for other things as well. Biden is an internationalist who understands his, you know, his life goes back to an immediate awareness of the dynamics of appeasing aggression in World War II. So he brings that lens. Trump is not an internationalist. He's an isolationist and an America firster. And if you believe that America should only look out for its own interests, I don't know how you can be confident that that's going to serve to protect the forces of democracy in China or in Taiwan.
Do you think the democratic recession in America will impact on the competition between United States and China and give Xi Jinping more advantage? Just like what he said, Dong Sheng Xi Jiang, the East is rising, the West is decline.
I think the prospects for U.S. domestic politics to impact upon China and either its domestic political evolution or its strategic posture across the street and strait and in the region, all of that will depend on what happens in the U.S. I think that there has been a partial reversal of the democratic recession in the United States and some strengthening of democratic institutions. We have a lot of work to do, and a lot is going to depend on what happens. Will we be able to make at least incremental steps toward reducing political polarization in the United States? We don't know the answer to these things yet, and those answers will tell us a lot about what it's going to mean for China.
Maybe we'll know more after the November election.
We'll know more, by the end of this year, and let's say by January 6th of 2025, when a new president is elected with the count of the Electoral College.
Okay, thank you so very much, Dr. Diamond,
okay,
for talking with us today.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you, too.